Next talk, Fred Jelinek is going to talk about random forests, which actually I like random forests.
Okay, so. I'm glad you like them. So what's a language model? So what it says is what it is. It's a probability distribution over word sentences. In speech recognition in particular, what you want to do is you want to be able to transcribe speech based on both the acoustics and what you think might be said. And this component of what might be said is the language model. And so in general, of course, what you want to do is you want to assign probabilities to word strings. And you know, without loss of generality, this is such a probability. It's the base theory. In speech recognition, of course, what you have is somebody speaks and produces some acoustics, and what you want to do is you want to find the most likely words that he said. So this formula, and if you do the formulation that is now common and has been common for the last 30 years, you take the view that there is a person who has something in mind to say, and he says it and produces acoustics, and we want to know what the acoustics indicate about the words. And so this formula is equivalent to this formula. Sanji's had it, and this component of this product is the language model. So the simplest way of doing a language model would be to somehow, is an n-gram language model, namely that the basic probabilities are curtailed, and shall we say that an equivalence classification is imposed on the past, and you make the last n minus one words count as a predictor of what might come next. And if you wanted to know this, you can do it. You can first approximation is to do an empirical relative frequency approximation. That means you go to some kind of a large text and you count up how many times the n-gram took place and divided by the number of times the n minus one of preceding words took place, and you get therefore the relative frequency, and that would be sort of the zeroth order approach to the problem. And of course, this won't work because the number of parameters, of course, is the vocabulary size to the nth power, and for any n worth its name, it's a huge number, and you never could get training data that would lack zeros. So the biggest problem in language modeling, in some sense, is the sparseness problem. And the sparseness problem is very serious. If you take a look at something called the UPenn tree bank, which we discussed, Eugene discussed it before, it's a million word amount of data, and you separate it from 82,000 words of test data, and you take the 10,000 most frequent words as your vocabulary, then the number of trigrams you haven't seen in this amount is 54% if you're interested in trigrams, 75% in 4 grams, 83 in 5 grams, and 86 in 6 grams. So it's obvious that we need to require some smoothing, and that it is impossible to simply use the relative frequencies as your estimate of the probabilities. Okay. More data is not a complete solution to the problem. I mean, we now have enormous amounts of data, of course, on the web, and people have tried it, And still, there are many trigrams that can, won't be observed. And besides, as was pointed out by someone here today, it's very important that the language model be, oh, Eugene, of course. it's very important that the language model be based on the data that you're going to estimate. In other words, if you're going to have speech recognition of doctors dictating their radiology reports, then you better take your basic corpus from there, and so that restricts the usefulness of data from other domains. So in-domain training is very important if you want to have some decent results, and in-domain training data is not always easy to get. So we need to do smoothing. In other words, we need to assign probabilities to words which to trigrams. Or the standard approach in speech recognition is trigrams. In other words, you predict the next word from the previous two. And the equivalence classification, therefore, is that the past is equivalent provided the last two words of the past are the same. And so there are various smoothing methods, and one of the and the best smoothing method is this one. In other words, and it's due to Nye and his former student Knezer. I think by this time he was an adult and was not a student anymore. But in any case, this is known as the Knezer-Nye smoothing. And what it does, if I did not subtract this D, that would be the relative frequency I had there before. But what you do is subtract some kind of amount of this count D, and you allocate it to things that you haven't seen. And what you see here is this is iterative, so the probability distribution for an n-gram is this kind of a modified relative frequency of an n-gram plus some interpolation with the same type of thing for an n minus 1 gram. All right? So the equivalence class is now larger here, and this keeps going until I get to a unigram, and then it's got something called a floor. So on top of it, there is a factor 1 over n, where n is the size of the vocabulary, all right? So this is an iterative procedure, and it turns out by, there are studies of it by Chen and, who's the other guy? Goodman, and they show that this, from all the methods that have been suggested, that this is the best, all right? Now we'd like to improve on it. And so what we're going to talk about is the approach that we are taking. Now, first of all, of course, it always seemed to us silly that this primitive way of equivalence classification, namely that you take the last n words to be the equivalence class, regardless how frequently the previous those last n minus words take place, etc., that's the best equivalence classification. So people thought, or we thought anyway at IBM, and made a big effort to see if we could get a better equivalence classification based on data. And that means that we would use something called decision trees. And random forests, which the preview for random forests is that these will be collections of decision trees, all right? But first of all, I'll start talking about decision trees. So that, by the way, the word sequence that precedes the word you want to predict, that's called the history. All right. So that's why that's what the terminology is. And the decision trees are an equivalence classification of history. And generally, can we get this slide here?
Yeah. John, you're in charge of turning the light on.
Well, anyway,
just push it.
Very good. So you ask questions here about that past, about that history, and depending how the questions come out, you end up in a leaf, and these leaves can be of various depth. And essentially, what you would have here, if that was my decision tree language model, I would have four classes of pests, and the classes would be all the histories that answer yes to this question, all the histories that answer no to that question, and no to this question, and so far and so forth. And these questions would be questions posed to the history. All right? And here is an example, and it also shows what the pitfalls of this example are. So suppose we have training data which has these trigrams, and so to start with, we're trying to predict what this word is going to be, and so obviously three times it's an A and twice is a B. So this would be the prediction would be based on this. And we could ask a question, and the question might be, is the first word in the set A, meaning first word of this history, all right? And of course, if the first word is A, so in this cooked up example, this, and this goes down this leaf, and this goes down this leaf. And in that case, it looks like that if the first word is an A, then for sure the word we're trying to predict is going to be an A. And if the first word was a B, then for sure it's a B. Now, naturally, that's overtraining, and we see immediately what the problems might be. So first of all, I might go into test data, and all of a sudden I would get the event AD, and which, by the way, happens to be followed by a B, but AD would get me over here and would predict that B can't take place. Here is another situation where the first word would be a B, and in fact, things would work out, but then there would be situations which are completely different, namely that the first word is neither A nor B. It happens to be a C, and then we're stuck right here, and we don't know what to do. So the problem with decision trees that one doesn't talk about too much, but which is very important, is that there is data or questions. Normally, one thinks of decision trees that there is a question, and then the complement of the question goes here. But if we really did it that way, then everything that has not been seen would go down here also, and there is no reason why to have this equivalence class. So we'll have to handle the not unseen situation as well. In other words, our questions from the training data will be questions about, will be really threefold. Is it in the training data, or is it a complement in the training data, or is it not in the training data at all? So actually, the tree will, even though the trees are shown as binary, they are really ternary. All right. So what kind of questions does one ask? Well, normally, because of sparseness of data, questions are not asked. And if I want to have a model of trigrams, then questions will actually not be asked about the bigram that precedes, but about the word in a particular position. So I will either ask questions about the previous word or about the word before that, or possibly about the better of the two predictions. All right? I will have to have a an evaluation criterion. The thing I'm discussing now is how to build this decision tree. And the decision to build it is that I've got to have a set of questions that I can ask, and I've got to have some kind of an evaluation criterion whether the question is effective or is not effective. All right? And so the way decision trees were done normally is that you asked the question about this position and evaluated the best question. You asked the question about this position, you evaluated it, and then whichever had a better value, that's really the question you ask, all right? Okay. So this this is a data-driven approach, and I already said what the construction requires. It's a set of possible questions, a criterion evaluating the desirability of the question, and a stopping rule, because you can't keep on going. If you keep on going to the very end, it will presumably improve all the time, but eventually you're going to overtrain, all right? And the danger is, if you go too deep, then you have overtrained, and if you go too shallow and stop too early, then you haven't asked something sufficiently refined. So the question in decision tree construction was always, in some sense, what the stopping rule ought to be. All right, and of course, as you keep asking the questions and you're going down this tree. When you try to determine this question, that's only that determination will be based on data that went down here already. All right. Consequently, it will not be based on this data. So as you keep going down and down, you're basing your decisions, your constructions on less and less data, and therefore again your construction will be less and less reliable. And that's where one of the main dilemmas of decision trees are. All right. One other way of doing it is to not have a stopping rule, to go all the way down and then prune. All right. And this is something called the card book, and they tell you how to do it. And essentially what you do is you keep going down and you see whether on some held out data, and you see whether stopping earlier is just as effective as going all the way. And as soon as you find a situation where it's just as effective from the point of view of the evaluation criterion, then you stop there and you prune the tree. And that would give you these depths, all right? And let's see, Breiman, Tomasian, I can't tell you the four names that are the authors of this book, but they've tried it very much. Okay, now, of course, I've already pointed out this business that there is a third possibility. In other words, that there is data that I have not seen, and of course it's worse and worse as I go deeper, that there will be data that I have not seen. So I've got to do, when I construct it, I have to provide some smoothing, and I've got to provide a methodology to assign probabilities to data that I have not seen in the training data. All right, because everything that I see in test data has to produce a probability distribution. All right, so there are two things that we have to do. One of them, a modified Knez-Nye. That means even if I have seen it, I will have to have a probability distribution over here at the leaves of the tree, and that will be done again by this kind of a formula. Compare this formula to the formula for the Knez-Nye that I had before. Here it was simply a count on the n-gram. Here it is a count on the equivalence class in that leaf and the next word. All right. But the idea of this smoothing is the same. And so what we're going to do is we're going to use this smoothing at the leaves. And furthermore, if I ever get somewhere where I can't answer the question, in other words, where the question is here or there, which happens to be the complement over the training data, but it's not a complement over everything, then I will simply use here the regular Knez-Nye probability, all right? So that's how I will solve the unseen data problem, all right? Okay. So when you do this, there is this data fragmentation I talked about already, namely that you make this decision based on less and less data. There is a lack of optimality because your decision criterion actually is entropy, and it's the local entropy, and you don't know, and it's greedy, and you decide the best question right there, and maybe some other question would allow me to make better decisions later, and there is the overtraining. And even though we are going to do pruning is just done on the basis of the held out data, and this held out data, of course, is not representative of everything, and so we have problems with that. All right, so I will show later on that, well, maybe it's time to show it right now. Well, here we are. I'll go back to it, but Knez and I, Trigram does this, and the best decision tree algorithm seems to give me a better perplexity. Who talked about, did you talk about perplexity? Yes. Somebody talked here about perplexity, and I will define it in just a moment. But what I wanted to show you is that on training data, of course, on held-out data, the decision tree trigram does better, but when you then put it on a test data, it's much worse. And that was the thing, that was the situation that we observed when we tried, I don't know, 15 years ago to create a better language model based on decision trees. All right. Now, Breiman came along, and I don't know how early he thought about it, but there is a paper from 2001, and his idea is that what we ought to do is our language model, or in his case, of course, he doesn't do decision trees for language models. He does decision trees, for instance, for deciding on diseases. So the question might be, you know, what is the temperature that the person had, and what did he eat, what's the blood pressure, and questions of that type might be asked. And he would create a collection of decision trees, and this collection of decision trees would be obtained based on randomized data in various ways, which I will not go into right now. And then he was going to make a decision, a majority decision. So in the case of decision trees of that type, they are called classification decision trees. And what you want to do is you want to know all these leaves lead to a prediction of a particular class from the set of classes. And so what if he will have a collection of, say, 20 decision trees, he will decide on the class which is the majority class. So here is an example where the collection is with three trees. There are classes alpha and beta. The first tree gets me at this leaf. The second tree gets me at this leaf. The third tree gets me at this leaf. The class alpha appears twice, the class beta once. So the decision would be, the classifier would say that the class was alpha, all right? Well, what we would like to do is adapt this. We would like to adapt this to decision trees for language modeling, and consequently, our decision trees are going to have distributions of next words, given that I am in this equivalence class. And so, if, for instance, the random forest consists of 100 decision trees, then it's simply going to be the arithmetic average of the distributions supplied by each of the decision trees among these 100. All right? And the question that I have to now tell you is, how is this probability distribution obtained? I have a collection of decision trees, and I've got to decide how will they differ from each other. And basically, there are three ways of randomizing things. One of the ways which Breiman did but it turns out that we don't find useful is to take your decision, you take your training data and select with replacement a subset of that training data. So each decision tree is based on a different random sample of training data actually with replacement. And the amount of training data that you select this way happens to be equal to the amount of the total data. I mean, I don't know if there is any theory to it, but it always is like that. I don't know why. All right, so that would be one way. The other way, the other randomness would be the randomness of the questions that are asked at this junction. And if you remember, I said that you can ask a question about the previous word or about the word before that, or the better of the two. And so we're going to do a Bernoulli sampling and decide at each position as I construct this tree, which one of these three possibilities I will ask as a question. So the point is that if I ask a question about a position, let's say about the second position from the one that I'm predicting, then I still have to ask what the question will be. And what it means is that I will have to divide the data into two sets, whether the word there is in this set or that set. And this gives me a third way of being random, namely that I select these sets at random, or at least in some way they are random. So what happens is, so the random character is that I decide at random on which position, and then I initialize something which is called the exchange algorithm, which means that I take the data that's at that position, divide it into two sets, and then I start, and those sets I select at random, and then I start exchanging words from one set to another, trying to optimize my criterion. And when I have optimized it, this is not global optimization, this is local optimization. When I have optimized it, I'm done, and that's the way I construct my decision tree. So, once more, we have two sources of randomness here, not three. We always do it on the same data, and it's the questions which at each node which are random, and these questions concern which position I will ask about and what the sets are going to be. All right? And this is my criterion of perplexity, and and the experiments that I that I am constructing are on trigrams, and of course we can do any number of n-grams. I mean, we can do 4 grams, 5 grams, whatever you. But the standard thing is trigrams, and you can see that here the perplexity improves. And even on test data, it's a considerable improvement. While the decision tree trigram construction gets worse than in perplexity, than the Knezenai trigram, when you do the random forest, you get better results. Now, what's interesting here is, one interesting thing is, how large a random forest do you need? In other words, how many decision trees should your collection have? And this curve is the curve that on test data. This is the result of the Knezenai. This is perplexity. And as you see already, this is the Knezenai. As you see already, at a collection of 10, we're doing better, all right? And we have conventionally gone down to 100, all right? But probably we didn't need to do that. Here is another analysis. Okay. Yes, sir.
Were the
questions being asked at each node basically an element of a trigram, or?
No, they are always, I have said that they have to do with positions. So I have the minus two position, I have the minus one position, and I am predicting this. And the question is the word, for instance, in this position in set A, or is it in set B?
Okay, I just wanted to understand whether you were actually allowing n to vary as one of...
What's
as
n? Part, I'm sorry.
The number of words you're allowing.
This can be the entire vocabulary.
The question is, can you go farther than a trigram?
Yes,
right.
And I will show some results what happens when you go to 4 grams or 5 grams. But this is strictly trigram. In other words, this has strictly only two positions where I ask questions. All right.
Meaning these results.
These results
are strictly trigram.
Are strictly trigram results. We're going to talk about it later. And the point is this: the question is, what is the perplexity for data that has not been seen, that has not been seen in the training? So I have here test data, and there I look at a trigram, and the question is, has it been seen in any of the decision trees or not, and has it been seen in the data that is the basis of the KNESNI? When I say has it been seen in the decision tree, because the equivalence classification is different in each of the decision trees, then it may be that what I have here, for instance, is the equivalence class followed by the words that were actually observed. So if a trigram falls into this equivalence class and is followed by the word which is in the test data, then I say this trigram has been seen. And therefore, the trigram could be seen in the decision tree, even though by itself it has not been seen in the data as itself. But as an equivalence class to which it belongs, it could have been seen. And so what we have here is whether the trigram was seen in no decision tree, in 1 to 9 decision trees, in 10 decision trees, etc. All right. And what it says is that if it hasn't, then the KNESNI approximation or smoothing is better. When it's been seen 1 or 9 times, it's still better. But from then on, there is a big advantage to the random forest. Here is another curve.
Oh, Fred.
Yes, sir.
Why is that last one so small?
I don't know. I guess because this is like the relative frequency. If it's been seen everywhere, that means there is simply no advantage.
Yeah, because that's a relative reduction of DPL.
This
so
is,
presumably
this is,
works pretty well. Anyway.
This is a relative reduction in perplexity of the random forest versus the KNESNI approximation.
So you're saying there's a huge difference between seeing it 99% of the time and seeing it 100% of the time?
I guess I'm saying it. I don't know. Okay, well, all right. I'll have to ask Peng. I mean, I haven't thought about it, but...
Sorry, I'm not your average listener here, so...
No, that's okay. I don't know. Okay, I mean, I assume, after all, I wouldn't have given him a PhD if he made any mistakes, right?
So far, we haven't found it, right?
So far, we haven't found it. All right.
By the way, I implemented all this stuff myself, and it really does work.
Testimony of... right. Okay, here is another kind of nice result. These are random forests. This is the stability of it, all right? And this is the average from this is the average from one random forest from for another random forest for another random forest. These are the perplexities. If you accumulate them, it slowly goes down. The result that I've quoted was this result over here. Perhaps it's not fair because, as you see, the next random forests were not quite as good, but if you were to accumulate it, then it gets better and better. What's amazing is now the following to me. We are doing this, but there is no reason not to try to, I mean, one would think that one decision tree might be better than another decision tree, consequently that the interpolation between decision trees might gain something if we allowed these coefficients to be trained. Turns out, doesn't do anything. Here it is, if you train it, all right, and do by EM and do an iteration. Of course, on this scale, it looks like we are improving, but in reality, we are the perplexity went down from 126.8 to 126.65. So there is this mysterious thing, at least to me, that just doing straightforward averaging rather than learning this doesn't do anything for us. Another possibility is, of course, to use the training data to construct the forest and then train what ought to be the distributions and the leaves. That's, again, another EM algorithm. In other words, how much... what should... Right now, the way we have distributions on the leaves is independent of all the other of all the other decision trees. The decision tree itself is constructed by itself, not in any view that it's going to be used with other decision trees together. Well, you can do that. You can try to see, you know, what you can gain if you take your decision tree, meaning decide on what the questions are, but use all 100, let's say, of these decision trees together and decide which way, where the data ought to go, essentially by the EM algorithm. That doesn't do anything for you either. So this randomness is a very powerful thing here.
You said you're not using the bootstrap resampling.
Yes.
Is that because it's worse or it's
No, it didn't do anything.
Right, it's just the same performance.
It's just the same performance, okay. So we might as well. It doesn't make it worse. It just doesn't do it. So here are higher order n-grams. As you see, we don't gain much. I mean, we gain a little bit when we go to 4 grams, even less when we go to 5 grams, but then we get worse. I don't know why. The Knez and I gains a little bit.
But here, presumably, the interpolation by Knez and I is much larger, right? Because you have a smaller fraction of the...
I don't understand. What do you mean the interpolation?
Once you go to a 4 gram or a 5 gram,
yes.
You have a smaller fraction of the space that you can really test.
No, I don't understand. What do you mean? The test data on which I tested is completely separate.
I mean the number of n grams.
So the interpolation is more important when n is larger because...
The sparseness problem that you mentioned at the beginning.
You mean the iteration... I don't understand you. I don't mean that you're wrong or anything. I just don't...
I think what he's saying is that in your decision, in your random forest,
yes.
In one tree of the forest, when
yes.
You go down the path,
yeah.
And you find that you can't put this history in an equivalence class because you simply haven't seen it in training.
Yes.
So then you're going to back off to the Knez-Erlin line.
Yes.
And so if you have a larger n-gram and you ask a question about...
I will be backing off to Knez-Erlin all the time.
More often.
Yeah. More often.
Okay.
I see, that's your point.
No, it's not clear to me that you will. It's just that... Because after all, the questions are random, so it's
if let's say the word in position number two was not in your set A or B, then that's when you would back off it.
That's right.
If you ask it about position six, I don't know why, if there should be a bigger reason why you'll back off.
But the equivalence class is, of course, as I go down, is the intersection of all these classes that I answered, and all of a sudden,
Well, you know, you and I have some doubts about our pruning mechanism.
Right?
Oh, well, that's another issue. But given that you're using the same pruning in both cases.
I had a different take on why you might not be pruning more, and I said this to Penn. You're still growing 100 trees.
Yes.
And with 6 grams, you're doing much more randomization. You have many more places to randomize now. So perhaps you should grow more trees.
Okay. Anyway, I don't know that I want to go into this here. We have another language model which is grammatical, and it's called the structured language model. And there is a trigram component of it, and we can do this this random forest to improve the trigram component of the structured language model, and there are some results here. I want to skip over this and rather end early and discuss here error rates, because what really counts is not the perplexity, but how it improves speech recognition. And here is here are the results on speech recognition, again, on speech recognition of something called the Wall Street Journal corpus. And here you see we gain something with the random forest here. But we gain less. The random forest is simply a very good method to smooth in data sparseness. And our suspicion is as the sparseness decreases, this is a random forest, and Knez and I built on the basis of 20 million words of data. I'm talking about the training data, and here it's on 40 million words of data, and the improvement is less. All right, this is the structured language model, which has that trigram component, and well, it improves like that. Again, in the structured language model, the trigram component can either be smoothed by the Knezana procedure or by the random forest procedure. So you gain, but you gain less. We wanted to put it to a more realistic and up-to-date test, which is the current, which is the 2004 conversation telephony system test. And there, just like Eugene was talking about re-ranking, what we essentially do is we re-rank something that's called a lattice, which is the set of possibilities of possible outputs. He was talking about n-best, 50 n-best parses. We don't do it by n-best. We have this structure, and every path through it is a possible transcription. And what we do is we re-rank those transcriptions. With originally they are obtained by a regular Knezana language model, and then we apply to it the random forest language model, and we get some improvement there too. Here it is, and we can and it has to do with from how much data we build our language models, both the Knezana or the random forest. And you know, if the amount of data is really huge, and I don't remember now what Fisher is, but what is it? It's like 100 million words of data. Or what?
I thought it was more like
400. No.
No, there is this web data.
This is
the web data.
Yes, this is the web data.
This is 400 million.
But the Fisher data itself.
Yeah, well, then we get these results, and here we get these results. Okay, I think there are of course practical limitations, namely that it is quite expensive to apply it. You've got to have it in your memory, and we haven't yet figured out a way in which to somehow really compress the random forest to something that would be real-time usable rather than for year ranking. I think that's the end of it.